Hello and welcome to Dyslexia Explored. I'm really excited today because we're going to talk about education, technology, dyslexia, and the whole marketplace of the potential of education, technology, assistive technology, and dyslexia. I've got with me today a man who's founded Mindset, which is an entrepreneur's gathering entrepreneurs and educators together in an incubator to incubate new ideas and bring them out into the world and help fund them and so forth. He's also the founder and CEO of the world's largest EdTech competition called the GES Award, the Global EdTech Startup Awards. And he's also on the board of three companies. He's got five children, four of them have got dyslexia. So I can't think of anybody more to have a great conversation about the intersection of education, technology, and dyslexia and the startup world than Avi Warsawski. Why don't you introduce yourself, Avi? It's great to have you here. I'm very excited to have a good conversation with you here about your dyslexia story.
Thank you, Darius. I'm really happy to be here as well. As you said, I'm running Mindset, and Mindset is for me a great opportunity to learn and to meet the ecosystem of startups across the globe. We started about 9 years ago when this edtech scene was pretty premature, and we grew with the ecosystem, which today is booming and really becoming to be much more dominant in the education world. And I think the interesting thing about startups is the fact that they are not taking for granted the world as it designed. They're looking always to find alternatives, to have some doubts. And I think it's a very healthy and interesting place to be in. And I'm most of my career I've been in education world, and most of my career also with startups in this field, starting myself in startups and then moving to more established companies. And about 9 years ago, we established Mindset, which is a spin-off of a CET, Center for Educational Technology. This is why we spell Mindset with a C.
I see. Yes. CET. Now, yeah. CET, is that like what's the background of CET?
Well, CET is a very interesting organization. It's an NGO dedicated to educational technology. And was funded about 50 years ago when the whole field was really, really young. Today, CET is the biggest player in the Israeli educational system, both the biggest publisher for education and also the biggest software house, which develops products which are very in the mainstream of education, like LMS system or e-books, etc. And about 9 years ago, CET realized that from the one hand, organization in the size of CET, which is very much embedded in the educational system in Israel, cannot move in the pace it should move. And from the other hand, all the intersection between technology, learning, knowledge have been changed so deeply that we need to find a different way to do it. And I was part of the CET management team and we decided to establish Mindset. Mindset has the privilege to think ahead a few years and suggest new solutions based on the work of startups.
And you're based in the Negev in Israel.
Yes, yes. We're based in the Negev for many reasons. Like CET headquarters is in Tel Aviv, and we also have an office in Tel Aviv. But we decided to establish Mindset in the Negev both because we believe that in periphery, there is much more opportunities and much more flexibility. And we see it mainly in the way that we can do pilots and work with schools and having a very good access to all the stakeholders in the area. And we're also interested in working with the underserved populations. And in the area that we're based in the Negev, there are some Bedouin tribes or nomadic traditional tribes with lots of unique situations and challenges, and it's part of the expertise that Mindset gained during the years is working with those kind of populations and bringing technology to their daily lives.
Fantastic. So you're basically going out to the edge and sitting in that sort of liminal edge place to discover new connections and opportunities.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Both physically and in the world of startups, often they start at the edge and then they get drawn into the center.
Yeah, it's a very good description, actually. And as I told you beforehand, we're based very close to the biggest crater in Israel. So we're literally on the edge
of the crater. I'm a student of permaculture, you know, which is called permanent agriculture. And permaculture studies, one of the principles of permaculture is to work on ecotones. An ecotone is where two systems join each other, like a prairie land meets a woodland, or water meets land. And often along the edge of something, it's more productive. They complement one another and they create an increased productivity and yield. And so you actually start to intentionally design extra edges, because often that's where the highest yield is. But we're not here to talk about the growth, but you're using the same principle there to find extra yield where these two worlds connect and complement one another.
Absolutely. Yeah. I like the metaphor. It's a very accurate.
So tell us a little bit about your dyslexia. So that's a bit about your tech story. Tell us a little bit about your dyslexia story. You know, what was life like before dyslexia came onto your radar? I mean, was there a time before dyslexia came on your radar? And what woke you up to dyslexia?
Well, I think my first encounter with dyslexia is my father. He's about to be 80 this year. And he was kicked out of school when he was 16 years old and sent to work because the teachers assumed that he cannot really cope with learning, and he's dyslexic, and I don't think he knew the notion when I was a younger kid, but as I grew up and the awareness to dyslexia started to be more out there, I think he also was exposed to the notion. And so through his lens, I think I learned a lot about this phenomena, and he, in a way, I think if I would ask him today whether he would prefer to be born without a dyslexia, I would say no, because I think many of the things he'd done in his life were an outcome of this challenge. Like, he's a very self-learner. And I think a lot of this comes from the dyslexia, because he always had to look for ways to learn individually, not through the main roads. And this made him to be very... I think brave about learning. Like, when I was in university, I learned philosophy, and I still was living with my parents. And one day I came with the Wittgenstein book from the university, and it was on the kitchen table, and I went to sleep, and in the morning I didn't find it. So, and then I met my father, and he said, "Oh, I saw this book. It was extremely interesting. So I read it the whole night." Now, it's extremely difficult book. It's like someone normal wouldn't think to read such a professional thing. But because everything was difficult for him, he takes everything like something that he has to cope with. And I think this is extremely essential characteristic of the way he lives and explores things and in a very a brave way. He always tries to challenge himself. He learned a few languages. It's extremely difficult for him to learn language, like much more than for me, let's say. But I think this is also something which I think comes from the dyslexia, like part of his journey to get over those challenges. He became to be someone who looks for challenges and try the most to be in all the time inside those challenges. So he reads a lot and he learns all the time. And in a way, this was my first encounter. Like, my father learned English the same year that I started to learn English in elementary school. Like, I was in fourth grade and I know nothing in English. And he was in the same level that I was. And he started there and afterwards learned German and French and Arabic and et cetera. So it's...
Wow. That's fascinating about how... What's a challenge to him? Everything was a challenge anyway. So the difference between easy and hard, it was kind of like, it's all a challenge. So I'll just take on a challenge, and even really big challenges like reading that intense philosophical book. Fascinating that. So are you dyslexic?
I don't think so. Like, I never had the direct problems that might be identified with dyslexia. I think maybe I have some kind of my kid says that I'm a bit ADHD, but I don't, it's not a professional observation. It's more like the way they see it.
Yes. Well, I was in the last episode, I was talking to some people who run a diagnostic center, five centers in Texas, and they diagnosed 1,200 assessments, intense assessments. What they said was the co-occurrence of dyslexia and ADHD is about 40%. And I have dyslexia, but I also think I have some unidentified ADHD. I've certainly got a lot of the traits, including the clicking of the pen that we just heard at the beginning of the podcast. Something has to be happening to maintain focus and attention. Okay, fascinating. So your children, they tell us a little bit about your story with your children. How did you discover they had dyslexia?
Well, first of all, my wife is an occupational therapist in her training, so she's very aware to those fields.
Fantastic. So
in early ages, she noticed that all of them have some kind of problems, and now each one is a different one. Like, it's not the same pattern in each one of them, but like my oldest son doesn't have any problems with reading. I think he has an ADHD, like he was also identified. And then my second daughter was very slowly reading and very slowly writing and had some difficulties in learning in general. And actually, I think only now when she's in the university, she started to learn like in a way that she never learned in school. Like, I think she closed the gap, but it took her some time to narrow this gap, which I think also affected her in the early years. In a very similar way for the way it affected my father. Like she always looking for things that are much beyond her capacity and struggles and never give up. I have another daughter, the number three, which is the opposite. Like I think her dyslexia is very slight, but it's in a way it stopped her. It's damaged her confidence. I think in her case also, I think the message that she received in elementary school was that like, trying to make everything easy for her and assuming that she's not like any other kids. And I think this damaged her, let's say, resilience. And although, like, objectively looking, I think her problem is less severe than the older sister. I think in her case, she's a very, she learns a lot from listening. And she has a very good way of memorizing things that she hears and understanding better, etc. But if she's forced to deal with text, she can do that as well. And I think both with her and with my two younger kids, it's also about executive skills, like arranging and organizing herself, etc. And my two younger kids, I think even their teachers are not aware that they have a dyslexia. Each one of them found his own strategy for coping with it. And both of them are very creative. Like, and again, I think as my father is also a very creative person, I think it's a sort of a package that comes together. Like they always have to look for strategies to manage themselves wisely. My son, my fourth son, is a very interesting dyslexia story in the sense that he's now in the army. He's 18 and 19 already. And until last year, he read only one book all his life. Like he was reading when he was required, but reading a book cover for cover, he read only one book. He was asking me different kind of questions about philosophy. And I told him about Plato and I read with him one of the dialogues of Plato, and Plato was mentioning Homer literature. So he decided he wanted to take a project of reading the Odyssea and then the Iliada, and he wrote both of them. He read both of them cover to cover, and it's all the time I'm telling him, man, people who read a lot not often really read those books entirely. Like they're quoting them, but it's not very common to see this kind. And it's very funny that out of three books he read in his life, two of them are like Greek classics literature. So I think, again, it's the same kind of phenomena.
Fascinating. I mean, I think I had a similar experience when I was like 15, 16. I came across Lord of the Rings And I hadn't read books very much before then because my dyslexia was mostly comics and Asterix and things like that. And I just read Lord of the Rings for like, I think 4 days and nights straight. You know, I had minimal sleep, just wanted to read. And I read it from beginning to end. And it's like super thick. And I it did something for me. It just kind of unlocked something and said, you know, it stretched me. And, you know, since then, I've probably read 500 to 1,000 books, you know.
Yeah.
But what was interesting there in all of those stories, you kept using the phrase, and they've caught up, you know, or closed the gap. And it's interesting, across there, there's this, your father has clearly closed the gap compared to his contemporaries in school and so on. He's way ahead of that gap, yeah. I imagine. And so have your children. And it's so often the case, isn't it, that there's this gap that's created in the high school years that then starts to close up. If they feel confident, though, I mean, it's not always the case, but it closes up in the 20s and then they accelerate forward. It's like they get catapulted forward into a deeper area of learning.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's I think this is maybe the big picture. And again, I think going back to my daughter, my third daughter, down there in this path, there is a lot of different lanes of gaps. Like, it's not just about learning gap or skills gap. It's, for instance, when she was younger, she used to ask me to go over the text that she was sending to her friends because yes. She was afraid that she has a spelling mistakes. And she does, of course. And I don't see this with my boys, like the younger boys sending over texts with mistakes and have no problem with this, but she didn't feel comfortable to do it. So I think those kind of issues are there.
I have a couple of daughters, both with dyslexia, one's 23 and one's 21. And the 21-year-old, often if she would ask us, how do I write this to them? How do I say this to a friend? So it could be a really important text about there's maybe a bit of a confrontation or something like that, or they just need to kind of say something quite right. And they're like, how do I say this? You know, and that sort of jumbling up of, you know, the ideas and thoughts and how to, if they were talking about it, they would get to the end, they would get to the point. But if they have to put it into a concise, structured text that doesn't get misunderstood or misrepresented, that can be a huge challenge. Have you found that with yours, that daughter? Is it just spelling or is it the way you say it, write it?
Well, it's interesting you mentioning this. I see it with my second daughter. Like she's really struggling with the, like, designing the sentences. And when she writes, she often writes very short and very concise and like a telegraph. And she needs always to work on adding more color for what she's saying and being less concrete.
Yes. And in text, that can be misunderstood as being short, rude, dismissive, you know, I'm not taking time over you. I'm just da-da-da-da, you know, yeah, no, maybe, etc. But it can be, and people read into text, did they say it like this? And it's fascinating. I'd say for anyone who's listening, one of the biggest hacks in text with kids is to put in emojis as well. You know, to put in a smiley face at the end, if it's a short text, put in a smiley face at the end to say, to counteract that impression that you're being dismissive or whatever, you know, it's a short but happy reply.
Yeah.
This podcast is sponsored by dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com, which helps you organize yourself creatively with a productivity system for Apple devices. So I was thinking, you live in this intersection of multiple worlds. So we've got the world of education, we've got the world of technology, we've got the world of startups, which is different from the world of technology because that's often the leading edge of design, creating solutions. And then in the world of dyslexia. What I'd really love to talk to you about is, where do you think the world of assistive technology, dyslexia, well, where do we start? I mean, do you use assist? What's your connection with assistive technology? Do you have any relationship with assistive technology companies, for example? Or where's your background in the assistive technology realm of startups, technology, dyslexia?
Well, in general, I can say that what we learned during the years, that usually a solution which designed for dyslexia or any other specific needs are usually relevant for everyone. In many cases, the difference between an assistive technology and the general technology is mainly business-wise, like a decision of the entrepreneur to go to a more specific segment and then and in the sales or in the business development area. But going down to the product itself, I think almost any feature which is relevant for kids with specific needs usually will be relevant for all the others. And I think, like, when thinking about assistive technologies, there are some things that technology, like the general technology, is already bringing a lot of assistance, like all the spell checkers, for instance, which has some downsides, but really make it easier in many senses. Technologies will help you to arrange your tasks or your to-do list or making order in notes, which is extremely important, I think, for kids with dyslexia or with people with dyslexia, but also relevant for anyone else. So this is one family of solutions that I think really changed the world in these senses. And the other ones are really the solutions that are designed specifically according to different kind of difficulties. And again, I can say that we have a connection with a company in the US that works with pretty wide scale with special needs, like this is the category, but in the end of the day, many of their users are not categorized this way. So it's I think it goes starting from different fonts or colors or stuff like that, going the deeper to other tools that simplify or make it shorter or any other ways of
Where do you think it's going to go in the future? Where is the future of, you know, there's two things. Where do you think things are going to go? And what do you think people can do? And they're slightly different in that I was speaking to, I don't know if you've heard about the book called Dyslexic Advantage.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. I don't know, have you read it by any chance?
No.
It's a fantastic book. And I was speaking to the author, one of the authors, Dr. Brock Eade, and she was talking about how people with dyslexia are often highly entrepreneurial. You know, they say about 40% of entrepreneurs are dyslexic when it's about 10% in the population. So a high proportion of entrepreneurs are dyslexic. However, what would be great is to have entrepreneurial dyslexics solving problems entrepreneurially for people with dyslexia, but actually often they don't. They go out into different workplaces and so on. And often there's a bit of a dearth of focus on what actual specific learning difficulties need, you know? And I would say that there's maybe we're at a realm where, you know, being able to type on your computer was an incredible assistive technology, you know, 20, 30 years ago, spell check 20 years ago, then voice to text, text to voice, electronic mind mapping, for example, was really helpful, structuring information, you know, task management, etc., that you've talked about. What do you think is next? And what could entrepreneurs do in that realm? Where do you see opportunities?
Well, first of all, I think I would divide between the entrepreneurs and the educators or the systems that are, I think in the entrepreneurs, I think looking on voice technologies, which are developing extremely interestingly in the last, let's say, 3 years. I think the potential there is huge in many senses, like both the richness of podcast world, but also the social voice platforms and the AI-based voice assistants. I think all those technologies can really change education in general and also affect some of the dyslexia challenges. So in this sense, I think there is a big potential. I think there is also sort of a risk, like going back to my own kids, and I think with each one of them, I saw sort of a struggle. They have to struggle with their challenge. They cross some kind of a Rubicon. Like there was in each one of them, it happened in a different age, but they came to a point that they have to really face a real effort to cope with this challenge. And when they crossed this gap, it became much easier, but they had to practice something which was for them practicing much more difficult than regular kids. And they had to do it for some time. And after practicing again and again and again, first of all, they found the strategies that were relevant for them, but also their brain became to be more practiced in a way, and the problem became smaller. And I think the risk with some of the technologies that you might not get to this point, that you will have to struggle and really cross this barrier. So I think in this sense, it might be also sort of a risk. And going to the educator side, it's amazing for me to see. I see now my kids are in university age, most of them. One is in school yet. And although the awareness to this phenomena is for a few decades now, it's still something that schools and educators don't know how to cope with in the practically sense. Like they know to send you to someone who will diagnose and maybe give you some out-of-the-box different regulation about how to behave, etc. But they don't really understand what it means. For many senses, like they might take it like looking at this as a very severe kind of defect or neglection that should be solved, or ignore it. And in both cases, I think it's a problem. So I think in this sense, we have mileage to go with really making it being part of the routine. And in the end of the day, I'm not a professional in those fields, but I believe that each one of us has a very specific way of learning and some things that are working faster, some things that are working slower, and many things that are working just differently. And in ideally, we should really be very much aware to all this map of our capabilities and the roadmap that we can create. And it should not be like regular kids and dyslexic kids. It should be like each kid tailoring his own conditions of learning.
Yes, yes. It's interesting that you bring up the first element of sometimes it makes it too easy. You're basically saying it makes certain things a little bit too easy, so you don't hit that barrier of breaking out. It's kind of like the chrysalis and the caterpillar. If you cut open a chrysalis and let the butterfly come out without them pushing, the butterfly dies. Yeah. Because the effort of pushing themselves out actually strengthens their wings so that when they break out, their wings are strong enough to fly. And you're kind of talking a bit about that chrysalis moment so that their wings are strong enough to fly, aren't you?
Absolutely. It's a very accurate metaphor, I think, for the same thing.
And what I found, I come from the world of mind mapping. I love mind mapping. Do you mind map at all?
Yeah, I love it as well. I really love it. And it's like always, it's my way of thinking.
Yes. So do you like to do hand-drawn maps or computer maps? What's your...
I prefer the hand-drawn ones.
Me too.
In general, I'm illustrating a lot. Like I used to be an illustrator when I was younger, and still I really like it very much. And I express myself with drawing, and I feel that the drawing by hand makes it totally different than drawing in other ways.
Now, there's an example, I think, where assistive tech sometimes doesn't help. For example, someone could say to you, Avi, you're dyslexic or you've got executive function difficulties or you're ADHD, you need to map out all your thoughts so that you can have them all in front of you and work out what you're thinking with your big picture brain. And so they give you a bit of a computer with mind mapping software and you start typing in, you think this is great, but then all of a sudden it's just words and blocks of words and branches and bubbles. And you start to get so overwhelmed because it becomes a database of information rather than a map of visual map of information. Whereas if you did it by hand, you've got doodles, you've got pictures, you can structure things, you're not fighting against the technology, et cetera. You're using a few keywords rather than the whole paragraph in a blob, et cetera. It creates better discipline, visual discipline for visual thinkers. And I think there is something that I feel technology took away from this tool of mind mapping 20 years ago, where it just became computerized. And yes, it's better sometimes than just plain text, but it took away doodling. It took away organic flow of things, and it became much more monotone. Has that been your experience of mind mapping, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, we are now working with a new startup, which is all about writing with hand on an ink-based notebook. And his thesis is exactly that we need to, in order to own what we are writing or drawing, we need to have this experience that we get from a pen and a paper, and it tries to preserve it, and from the other hand use technology afterwards to package it, to navigate into the different pages. And by the way, this entrepreneur himself is a very relevant story, because he had a startup in a totally different domain and did very well and sold it, and he had an exit. And after the exit, he decided to stay at home and work with his five grade kids that was struggling in school. And he said, I want to crack it. And he really sat with his kid for about 3 or 4 months, really going with him day by day over his school issues. And his conclusion was that it's all about the way things are arranged for his kid. Like, his kid is also with ADHD and dyslexia, et cetera. And when he started to help him organize his learning environment and his notebook and his equipment, etc., he saw that things are getting better dramatically. So he built all his solution based on those anchors.
Yes, I mean, I remember with my daughter when she was 14, and she totally, you know, got stressed out because of her dyslexia. We only really noticed it then because of the organizational challenges, the executive function challenges that come with it, the working memory challenges, the processing challenges. It's not the phonological processing that was the big deal for her, the words and so on. It was the actual processing of the information and organizing of it. She failed a biology. She was a straight A student. And then she failed, got a D in a biology test exam. And she was like, I don't understand what just happened. And I said to her, I'll teach you my mind mapping technique that I used to get through my law degree. And she said, okay, I'm ready, Dad. And what we did was I said, show me your folder. And she brought out this folder. It wasn't even punched or anything. It was just this hodgepodge. And we opened it up and I said, so where's the beginning? And she said, well, I'm not sure. I just threw it all. There was no beginning, middle, and end. Okay, fine. Fair enough. I totally understand. So we took the whole folder and we stood in the middle of the floor and we created a circle all the way around us. And I said, where does this come in the order of what you learned? She said, well, I think that comes over there. And then that goes over there. That goes over there. And we just did that. And we created this clock face of the beginning, the middle, the end. And even that was a moment for her where she was like, my goodness, is that all I need to learn? Because one of the things that sometimes people with dyslexia do is they expand the scope of something because they're such big picture thinkers. They think they must need to learn about this kind of biology and that kind of biology and this kind. No. All we're doing is this and everything inside the circle, and that's it. The rest of it for another time. And that was a wonderful experience to go through that process. So is he doing it on an iPad, or is he doing it on a new device? Or
he's using a new device, which he is not it's not his device, like he's buying this device from a manufacturer in China. And the device is a notebook based on ink, like the very similar to the Kindle.
Okay.
And the look and feel is very similar for working with a pen on paper. Like, now, of course, there's a lot of challenges bringing into the educational system another device.
Wow, yeah.
Which he has to solve. But still, I find it a very interesting initiative.
Well, I think we are on a bit of a worldwide, on a bit of this convergence of doing things by hand, naturally by hand, doing things by voice naturally, and doing things by text on a screen and structure. Because we've gone from text, we've then gone into hand, we've gone from text, we've then gone into voice, drag and dictate and that sort of thing, and now more voice stuff. And now we've, with iPad, for example, and Surface Pro, we've gone into hand, and people can take handwritten notes on their iPad. And so we've now got the actual infrastructure to start integrating these natural human ways of doing things by voice, by hand, and by finger.
Yeah, I think it's also maturity. I agree with you. Like, I think it's a maturity of technology that with all the IoT trends and understanding that technology is not just about screen and the speaking heads, it's like much more rich and can be in all the space. I think it's really a game changer in this sense.
I have a theory, okay? With the apps that I'm going to develop in the future, I want to have machine learning at the center of it, because I think often people with dyslexia are very early adopters of technology that assists them. So like you said, it can help everyone. So for everyone, it's helpful, spell check, for example. For people with dyslexia, it's absolutely essential. So there are certain things that are absolutely essential, and people with dyslexia often are early adopters and not just adopt it, but integrate it into their life. And I suspect many of them will adopt and integrate machine learning and AI into their life much faster, because it will become much more essential for them rather than a nice add-on. You know, I'm using WordTune, which I think comes from Israel.
Yeah, it does. It comes from Israel, yes. I know the founders.
Do you know them?
Amazing. Yeah, it's an amazing tool.
It's incredible. I mean, I'm sitting there with dyslexia, and just for those of you who are listening, WordTune is a plugin that you can get for free or pay for, depending how much you use it. And you select a sentence, and you click on it, and it gives you six other different ways or more of saying the same thing. And when you look at it, you go, oh my goodness, that says it better than I do. And I look at it and I go, my goodness, that's saying it like a grown-up does. Because often I realize the way I write is like a child, and it's often the way I speak. And that's just part of my dyslexia. But then it gives me a phrase and I click yes, and it changes it. I go to the next one, I go to the next one, I go to the next one. It's just phenomenal. I mean, Grammarly is phenomenal as well.
Yeah.
And all these developments of AI, I think people like me, it's not just a nice to have, it becomes an utter essential to have.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree. And also, I think, again, my non-professional observation is that dyslexic people are early adapters in many senses, in general. Like, looking at my father, his technological skills are really amazing for his age. And he's not afraid to test new stuff and to gain new skills. And
I think often people with dyslexia and ADHD, often with dyslexia, it's we need to externally process information. So we need enough headspace to think creatively, that the mundane automatic stuff and so on, we delegate to a tool outside of that, whether that's paper and pen in a notepad, or we draw all out so we've got it there and it's out our head and we can think. We're always looking to externally process. So we're looking for tools. We either adopt the tools or we create the tools. Steve Jobs was dyslexic, you know. And then if you look at not just Steve Jobs and Apple being dyslexic, but the next guy down, Johnny Ives, who actually designed the iPhone and Mac, he's dyslexic, and you just cascade it down. You could probably find this combination of dyslexia, ADHD, and autism all kind of working in synchronicity with each other, and typical thinkers as well. But this adoption isn't just, it becomes an imperative, a compulsion, because you just need it. I need to write this down because I can't remember it in my head, or I need to process this externally, whereas other people can, I can do it without it.
Yeah, I think it's very accurate. And I think also this is maybe part of the secret sauce that makes sometimes dyslexic people better in those kind of things, because you are stopping yourself and you're doing something that maybe someone else would do faster, or will think that he's doing faster because he has the practice, and you have really to stop, really give it another thought, do something manually, and then the quality is higher.
Yes, I don't know if you've probably not heard my analogy, this analogy. I came up with this analogy to help children with dyslexia understand what slow processing means, you know, and I said, it's like a car. You know, you get automatic cars and manual cars. You get an automatic Ferrari and a manual Ferrari, same engine, just different gearbox. Person with dyslexia is like a manual stick shift who has to process information very intentionally, go up the gears and to get to full speed. Whereas typical thinkers are automatics. They put the power on, they brake, accelerate, brake, don't need to think about the gears very much. And if you don't know how to go up the gears, you stay stuck in first gear and you're going like 60 miles an hour in first gear, burning through gas, damaging your engine, feeling exhausted, and never getting up to full speed in your Ferrari, because Ferrari's powerful engine, but you can't go very far on first gear. You need to go up the gears. And so with everything that involves processing isn't necessarily slow, it's just manual. And that manualness becomes a process of intentionality. And when you start becoming super intentional about every step, you start identifying where problems are and how to solve them. And that's the beginning of entrepreneurship.
Yeah, it's a very accurate analogy. I like it. It's a very great way to present it.
So AI, what's the future of AI and dyslexia, do you think? Because I think there's a big, AI can do a lot for people with dyslexia and this sort of integration of, because basically AI is taking predictable structured processes and automating them. And if we're thinking that a dyslexic mind is very manual at doing things, if something could come in and make it automated so that you can concentrate on the more creative aspect and something else can work on the manual, laborious, procedural aspect, then you've got a great collaboration there between a person and AI. I'm looking forward to it personally when I can work with an AI or just machine learning at the very least. I mean, okay, talk about AI in the future, but there's some very significant developments with GPT-3, OpenAI's GPT-3, and the potential it's bringing, and all sorts of different opportunities that are out there for startups, and even, maybe even in the future, dyslexic teenagers who are sitting there in their bedroom, 14 years old, 15 years old, thinking, I wonder if I could get GPT-3 to do X, or by then it might be GPT-5.
Yeah.
Who knows what GPT-5 could be? But just for the listeners, GPT-3 is the name that OpenAI has created. What's it? General Purpose? I can't remember what the acronym stands for. But it's a very powerful AI that can do a whole range of things out of the box. It can do voice to text, text to voice, it can create art from descriptions, it can write text for you, whole paragraphs, whole essays, all sorts. And it's getting very close to being as good as the average human at it. So it's really going somewhere, and that's just GPT-3. What are your thoughts on the whole AI side of things and potential?
First of all, I agree. And in a way, what you are describing is happening in some ways already. You mentioned WordTune, and WordTune is a product of a company called AI21. And it's only one of their products, and they opened an API that each one of us can create stuff over their technology. And it's amazing. Like, you can do so many things with their technology. And I think we're going to see more players like this down the road. I know that in the EdTech, there is a very big Korean company called Reed, like R and three times I, that are aiming to a very similar vision, like bringing AI capabilities for EdTech players to design their own solutions. And even looking on the cloud, in what Google or Microsoft or AWS are offering right now, you can do a lot without having deep understanding of AI or machine learning, like just with having some technology literacy. And so I believe we're going to see very soon tailor-made solutions, that some of them could be from this family of doing the more routine stuff by the machine and leaving the human being the other things. It could be about rethinking about text, which is actually AI21, going back to their example. They have a text generator that you cannot imagine that it was not written by a human being. Like, you are telling what you want to write about and you're getting a full text, which is it's unbelievable. And this, of course, defines or redefines the whole world of writing and reading and evaluating outcomes in this field. And also, I think there's a lot to do about personalization and really finding the right suit for each user that makes it the best way of learning and writing and organizing knowledge, etc.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic, Avi. This has been a great conversation. Thank you very much. Is there anything, I don't know, anything final thing, thoughts you'd like to share?
Well, first of all, saying thank you. Like, I think it's a very interesting opportunity for me. And I think my personal encounter with dyslexia gave me a window to understand a little bit about this interesting and rich phenomena. And I think you're doing a very important thing in taking out this message and help us all learn more about this. I think it's extremely important. And going back from maybe the point we started with, I think, as you mentioned, lots of entrepreneurs are having a dyslexic background and maybe looking into the future, hopefully we'll have much more sophisticated way of classification of ourselves. I think it might be a way to identify also talents, not just challenges, which I really believe that should reposition the discourse about dyslexia and brand it like something much more neutral, and that brings also the opportunities beside of the challenges.
Yes, I think that often in the world of adult dyslexia, I think it's really helpful I had this conversation with an author who wrote Adult Dyslexia, a great book. And she was saying, when you disclose that you have dyslexia, often it's really helpful to start off with, I have dyslexia. I'm really good with problem solving, creative problem solving, solving things dynamically, crisis situations, knowing, you know, the best course to take and creating tools and techniques and strategies. But I do have some difficulty with reading long documents. I need extra time, and sometimes my spelling and grammar is not that great. Yeah. And then it's sort of, you know, put into context rather than, oh, I have dyslexia and that's it. You know, you're constantly framing it.
Yeah. I think it's the right way to do it. It's like setting the stage in the right tone.
Yes. It's not just doing... It opens the door to let the person see you for your abilities, and also to hands up say, my spelling's atrocious and my grammar sometimes gets in my way, so please help me whenever that happens. Feel free to point it out. I won't take it as a personal slight. Avi, it's been fantastic having you on the podcast. And if anybody is, you know, do you take entrepreneurs that are just in Israel? Or
no, we work actually globally. Like about 50% of our startups are from Israel, but the rest from other countries as well.
I see. And so you know, this might be an opportunity if you are dyslexic as an adult, or if you've got a dyslexic child who's listening to this as a 16, 17 year old and thinking, I want to get into tech and startup world. You might be listening to this in a few years' time. Go and look at these incubators where you can take this. And there's something fascinating about an incubator as well for someone with dyslexia, because you know, I would love to have been in an incubator with Bullet Map Academy, and the companion company is called Dyslexia at Work, which is mm-hmm. for adults, which we've just raised some funds for in the last month, actually. I could see a lot of advantages for people with dyslexia, because you're in a group, you're talking, you're being inspired by one another, you've got some direct input, you can still have your individuality and so on, and there's this time-bound 3.5 month period where you get something done. So these are all very helpful things for people with dyslexia or ADHD to get that creativity out, isn't it?
Absolutely. And like in the ideal world, I think schools should look like more like incubators than schools.
Oh, that's a fascinating discussion. And I totally agree with you. You know, schools as incubators, wow. Gosh, that's a bit of a boom moment for me, actually.
Yeah.
Wow. Yes. I don't know if you've come across Christopher Alexander's work called Pattern Language. He's an architect.
No.
Anyway, one of the things he suggested within his architectural design of cities and towns was that schools should have satellite companies, that and the companies should be organized so that they get paid for a day a week to bring in a group of kids into the architectural office and do some sort of incubator type activity where they get given a challenge that is an open-ended challenge. There isn't one right answer. It's a creative project, you know? That's very similar to that incubator idea, isn't it?
Yeah, interesting. I'll look for it.
Well, Avi, we could talk so much more. Thank you very much for being here on Dyslexia Explored.
Thank you, Darius. Really a pleasure. And looking forward to be in touch.
Thank you.
This podcast is sponsored by dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com. It's my day job when I'm not hosting this podcast. Tell me, do you know what you want to achieve in the workplace, but you're struggling with how to achieve it? Maybe you suspect some traits of dyslexia are getting in the way. Well, that's where Dyslexia Productivity Coaching comes in, because we give you a simple productivity system for your Apple devices that harnesses the creativity that comes with your dyslexia. It includes proven methods like note-taking, reminders, speech-to-text, mind mapping, and more, all tailored to your needs. It'll free up your time and help you achieve outstanding results. Book a complimentary call to discuss it with me, and if you do it soon, I may also be available to coach you personally via Zoom. So don't be shy, go to dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com or swipe up and book it now.